I now give the floor to the representatives of China.
Mr. President, China voted in favor of the draft resolution that was just put to vote. The Palestine issue is at the core of the Middle East issue. It is a root cause issue of the Middle East peace, within which the issue of Jerusalem is particularly complicated and sensitive and involves the basis for finding a solution to the Palestine issue. For many years, a series of Security Council resolutions, including Resolution 2334, made stipulations on the issue of Jerusalem. The draft resolution put forward by Egypt is a continuation of the content and spirit of past Council resolutions. We urge the Security Council and the international community to remain united in a common effort for a sooner cooling off of the situation related to Jerusalem, so as to maintain regional peace and security of the Middle East, as well as the overall Middle East peace process. China has consistently and firmly supported and pushed for the Middle East peace process. We support the just cause of restoring the legitimate national rights of the Palestinian people, support a fully sovereign, independent state of Palestine, taking 1967 borders as the basis, and with East Jerusalem as its capital. Such a position of China will not change. China will continue to be generally guided by the four-point proposal put forward by President Xi Jinping of China this past July on pushing for a solution for the Palestine issue, advance a political solution based on the two-state solution, and promote peace, stability, and development of the Middle East. We urge the international community to adhere to the relevant resolutions of the UN Security Council, Land for Peace Principle, and Arab initiatives to strengthen the effort for the resumption of peace negotiations and find a solution to the key issues, including the final status of Jerusalem, through dialogue and negotiation, so as to achieve a comprehensive, just, and lasting solution to the issue of Palestine at an early date. Thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the representative of China for his statement. Now I give the floor to the representative of the plurinational state of Bolivia.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Bolivia voted in favor of the draft resolution presented today by the delegation of Egypt because it reaffirmed that the definitive status of the city of Jerusalem should be resolved through negotiations, and that any decision or act that seeks to change the status or the demographic composition of Jerusalem should not have any legal effect whatsoever. They should be null and void, and they should be revoked in accordance with the relevant UN and Security Council resolutions. Furthermore, it reaffirms that if we see a continuation of the efforts on the ground that are endangering a two-state solution, we must ensure that we continue efforts to achieve broad, just, and lasting peace in the Middle East. We therefore call once again on the government of the United States of America to reconsider its decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and to remove its diplomatic representation from that city, because it would only undermine any possibility of a dialogue between the parties and further make it even more difficult to reach a peaceful long-term solution to this conflict. This is also in flagrant violation of Resolution 480 of 1980, which also refers to the withdrawal by member states of their diplomatic representations from Jerusalem. Once again, we wish to recall that it was the United Nations which provided for the international status of the city of Jerusalem. And it was also this Security Council which reiterated that all measures that changed the geographic, demographic, and historic character of the city of Jerusalem were null and void and should not have any effect. Bolivia is no less convinced that the sole long-term alternative to solving this conflict is the two-state solution, where we will eventually see a free, sovereign, and independent state of Palestine take shape with its pre-1967 borders, with East Jerusalem as its capital, in accordance with the relevant Security Council and General Assembly resolutions. Thank you very much, sir.
I thank the representative of Bolivia for his statement. Now I give the floor to the representative of Kazakhstan.
Thank you, Mr. President. Our delegation voted in favor of the draft resolution proposed by Egypt. Kazakhstan's position on the Middle East peace process remains unchanged. My country urges the parties to maintain the historical status quo of Jerusalem in accordance with previously reached international agreements. We support negotiations resulting in the two-state solution and stand for the early resumption, especially in the bilateral format and without preconditions. The ultimate goal should be the restoration and promotion of the peace process in accordance with relevant Security Council resolutions, the Madrid Principles, the Land in Exchange for Peace formula, and the Roadmap of Peace and Arab Peace Initiative. It is also necessary to identify mutually acceptable principles for the advancement of the peace process, as well as to develop a concept for future negotiations and the implementing mechanism. We, therefore, urge the leaders of Israel and Palestine to take concrete steps in their alia that will strengthen the prospects for peace based on the inalienable right of the Palestinians to statehood and the right of Israel to its own durable long-term security. I thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the representative of the Kazakhstan for his statement. I shall now make a statement in my capacity as a representative of Japan. Japan's position on the Middle East peace process remains clear and steadfast. Japan supports a two-state solution and believes that the final status of Jerusalem is a part of a range of issues that should be resolved through negotiations on the basis of the relevant Security Council resolutions and previous agreements between the parties. With this in mind, Japan has voted in favor of the draft resolution. Japan carefully listened to the statement of Ambassador Haley today. Japan appreciates President Trump's reaffirmation of his strong commitment to facilitating a lasting peace agreement and support for a two-state solution in his recent announcement, and notes well the importance of the President's clear acknowledgement that the final status of Jerusalem, including the sovereign boundaries within the city, must be subject to negotiation between the parties. We welcome that the U.S. will continue to play an important role in advancing the peace process. We are concerned about the possibility of the worsening of the environment surrounding the Middle East peace process, or the deterioration of the situation of the wider Middle East region. The continuing unrest on the ground is worrisome. It is important that the parties commit to making meaningful progress in the peace process. Japan appreciates the efforts made by the member states to bring parties closer to the negotiating table. Peace can be achieved only through negotiations between the parties. Japan, too, will continue to be constructively engaged in this issue to promote an environment conducive to meaningful negotiations with a view to achieving a two-state solution. I resume my functions as the President of the Council. I now give the floor to the permanent observer of the Observer State of Palestine.
Sayyid al-Rais.
Mr. President, at the outset, I would like to thank Japan in its capacity as Security Council President for convening this important meeting. I would like also to thank all the members of the Security Council, the 14 members who voted in favor of the draft resolution, those who have recognized the urgency of this matter and the need for serious follow-up and action in light of the recent provocative decision announced by the United States of America, contrary to the relevant United Nations resolutions regarding the Holy City of Jerusalem. We are also grateful to the Arab Republic of Egypt for its efforts and for submitting this draft resolution as the Arab member of the Security Council. Mr. President, the total rejection of this U.S. decision and the international consensus on Jerusalem are beyond clear. The message has been unequivocal. All Security Council's resolutions concerning the status of the Holy City of Jerusalem and the rest of the Palestinian territory occupied by Israel since 1967 are legally binding. Legally binding and must be respected without question and without exception, including Security Council Resolution 2334 of 2016, which constitutes a roadmap, and it is an entrenched resolution in the international law. It only reflects reality. And the latest U.S. decision on Jerusalem lacks this reality. The same applies to their rhetoric today and in the morning and in the afternoon. They run counter to reality, and we totally reject them. Again, we reject them in their entirety. With regard to Resolution 2334, it clearly condemns settlements, violence, and terror against civilians. And it calls for promotion of the efforts of peace. This is a big mistake when it is said that the implementation of the international law and not the building of illegal settlements is the thing that stands in the way of peace. This is a farce. When the Security Council and its resolutions and the international law become the problem rather than the illegal position of the occupying power and settlement, as we heard today from the permanent representative of a major power and a member, a permanent member of this council. This was also strongly reaffirmed by the statements of states and civil society organizations across the world. And in the emergency meeting of the Security Council on the 8th of December, and through the decisions of the Arab Ministerial Council held in Cairo on the 9th of December, and the summit of the Organization for Islamic Cooperation, OIC, held in Istanbul on 13 December. And the position of the African Union, among others, and today in the overwhelming support of the Council members for the draft resolution just voted upon today. This veto stood in the way of the adoption of this resolution, but the international will find other frameworks for its position in the days to come. The draft resolution reiterates that any decision aiming at changing the character and the status of Jerusalem has no legal effect, and it should be null and void. It should be rescinded in accordance with Security Council resolutions, and it calls on all states not to recognize any measures or actions that run counter to this fact, and it calls on them not to establish political missions in the Holy City. It also calls for intensifying international and regional efforts aimed at achieving a just, lasting, comprehensive, and peaceful solution based on relevant UN resolutions, international legitimacy, and the peace principles in order to end the Israeli occupation of our territory, including in East Jerusalem. The result of the vote is a demonstration of the position of the international community that recognizes the sensitivity and the specificity of the situation and the status of Jerusalem and the Palestinian right to this city. However, and regrettably, one state decided to oppose the whole world and to stand against the whole world with regard to this long-standing issue that has always been respected by all, including the former U.S. administrations since 1947, and decided to stand by Israel, the occupying power. That contravenes the international law and all the international legitimacy resolutions, day by day and in a flagrant manner. Regrettably, the United States chooses to disregard the international law and to ignore the international consensus, to stand with the Israeli occupation at the expense of our rights and the just nature of our cause. With this veto, the United States has missed an opportunity to correct its illegal decision with regard to Jerusalem, and it has persisted in its historic sin. We reiterate once again that this U.S. decision will have no legal effect that would alter the character and the status of Jerusalem by any means. This resolution affects the status of the United States as a peace broker, and it actually stresses its bias, and it undermines its role in any future peace process. What we heard today is a total bias, 100% in favor of the occupying power, rather than a neutral position between us and the Israelis. It is paradoxical that while we were awaiting a peace plan from the U.S., the administration instead decided to further obstruct peace and delay its realization. This underscores yet again the failure of the old formulas, and there should be a new mechanism away from the old formulas and imperative of a collective process going forward. The Security Council's resolutions are binding, and they remain valid until their implementation. A veto cannot negate adopted resolutions. No veto in the past has been able to do so, and no veto in this era ever will either. It is truly paradoxical that the same state casting its veto today asserts the Council's authority in all other cases, demanding respect of resolutions on every other issue aside from Palestine. When it has to do with Palestine, there is imbalance. We refuse to accept that Palestine be the exception to every rule, and the international community has concurred, speaking in one voice, insisting on respect for the applicable laws and resolutions that are the core of the peaceful solution to the Palestinian question. The U.S. decision encourages Israel to persist in its crimes against our Palestinian people and to continue its occupation of our territory. No rhetoric will hide this complacency in prolonging the occupation. No veto can conceal these facts, nor can it legitimize any provocative unilateral decisions or actions in violation of Security Council resolutions. No one can deny that such provocations fuel the unending cycle of tension and can ignite religious sentiments among billions of Muslims and Christians across the world. Everyone knows that these actions makes peace more elusive, more than ever, and threaten to transform this political and regional conflict into a devastating religious conflict with grave consequences on international and regional peace and security. It only benefits the forces of extremism and terror. Therefore, we caution once again against such recklessness, and we call for full respect of the historic status quo at the holy sites, including at Al-Haram al-Sharif, and of the special custodial role of Jordan in the protection of the Muslim and Christian holy sites. We will continue all efforts and coordination in this regard to ensure such a protection and to rebuff all provocations and illegal measures undermining the historic status quo. Mr. President, this illegal and irresponsible decision will change nothing for the Palestinians. Jerusalem will always remain the heart of Palestine. Our history, our culture, our heritage, our religion as Muslims and Christians is so attached to this city. And it is woven in its history. It is the cradle of civilization and the land of messages. East Jerusalem remains occupied and an integral part of the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967 and is the capital of the state of Palestine as recognized by the majority of the states around the world. But this resolution has permitted Israel to continue its settler plotting and scheme and to encroach on the Palestinian rights, rather than deterring Israel and compelling to respect the international law to achieve peace and security. Therefore, once again, we call on all peace-loving nations around the world to stand firm for the rule of law and in support of the steadfast Palestinian people defending their land in Al-Quds, Jerusalem, defending their land, identity, holy sites, and their natural place in history and geography, and to oppose injustice, oppression, and subjugation. Mr. President, while the world will be celebrating in the coming days Christmas and the birth of Jesus Christ, lights will remain turned off in the land of Jesus Christ, and celebrations will not take place in Jerusalem, Bethlehem, or Nazareth, as joy has been stolen from us by a decision that, in the name of realism, has denied reality and violated the rights of an entire nation and insulted the feelings of believers around the world. Protests have erupted against this decision, not only in Palestine, but across the globe, in defense of justice, freedom, and dignity, and in rejection of colonialism and unilateralism. In Palestine, thousands have demonstrated against the U.S. decision and were faced with killing, repression, arrest, and oppression by the Israeli occupying forces. 11 Palestinians have been killed. 3,500 have been wounded and hundreds arrested. 500 were shot. Israel have also detained hundreds of our people, including children. We pray for the families of the martyrs, and we wish speedy recovery for the wounded and freedom for the detained. We question, how many sacrifices do we have to introduce in order for our people to enjoy their rights on a par with the rest of the nations of the world? We reiterate that the arrogance of the occupying power will only strengthen our position to liberate our land and to achieve independence, restore our rights and dignity. The time is past due for our people to achieve their rights, including to self-determination, and to finally live in freedom, dignity, peace, and security in their independent state of Palestine, with East Jerusalem as its capital. Side by side with all the peoples of the region and the globe, we urge you to continue to firmly stand on the side of right. Those who want peace do not recognize illegal actions and measures, but rather recognize all rights of the Palestinian people as enshrined in international law and UN resolutions, and recognize the state of Palestine and stand with freedom, the key to ensuring that peace can finally prevail in the land. Thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the permanent observer of the Observer State of Palestine for his statement. I now give the floor to the representative of Israel.
Thank you, Mr. President. Today, the United Nations has taken another step backwards, another step away from advocating for truth and justice. Almost exactly 1 year ago, in this very same room, this body adopted the shameful resolution 2334. It was a resolution that had the audacity to try to designate Israel's presence at the Western Wall, at Judaism's holiest site in Jerusalem, as a flagrant violation of international law. Those words pierced the hearts of Jews everywhere. They mocked the generations of Jews who prayed toward Jerusalem for thousands of years. They belittled the ancient declaration of the Jewish people that states, next year in Jerusalem. Yet, here we are again. We still find ourselves fighting the same battle for truth and morality. Those who voted for today's resolution have only reaffirmed the UN's decades-long double standard when it comes to Israel. They are guilty of blatant hypocrisy. Every other country in the world has the right to designate its capital city. But when it comes to Israel, somehow this most basic national right is questioned and condemned. We thank the United States for staying loyal to the truth and vetoing this absurd resolution. President Trump, Vice President Pence, Ambassador Haley, and the entire administration proved that the United States does not back down from what's right. They continue to advocate for real dialogue and a hope for peace in our region. The Palestinians, however, have once again displayed a disturbing trend. Every time the prospects for meaningful negotiations emerge, the Palestinians run away. Every time there is a chance for hope, the Palestinians sabotage the effort. All too often, the international community only makes it worse. In 1947, the Palestinians rejected Resolution 181. In 2000, they walked out of the Camp David talks and began a war of terror against Israelis. And in reply to Prime Minister Netanyahu's repeated offers to negotiate, the Palestinians have just one response: give in to our demands or suffer the consequences of incitement and violence. The American administration is now working tirelessly to revive negotiations. They, like us, are eager to spark a new hope for peace. By declaring the obvious that Jerusalem is the capital of the State of Israel, President Trump was simply stating a fact. He hoped to encourage both sides to move forward at the negotiating table. But the Palestinians once again responded with endless rockets fired at our civilians. Mr. President, let me be clear. We will continue to stand strong when it comes to Jerusalem. We do not back down. 3,000 years ago, King David declared the city of Jerusalem the capital of the Jewish people. Jerusalem has been Israel's capital for almost 70 years. Our nation has never given up when faced with adversary. We will not allow others, including the United Nations, to determine our fate, especially when it comes to Jerusalem. Not then and not now. This week, Jews all over the world are celebrating the holiday of Hanukkah. We welcome the good wishes sent from so many nations, many of whom are represented at this table today. But it seems that some of those who wish us well have forgotten exactly why we celebrate Hanukkah. Hanukkah is not about gifts. It is not about food. Hanukkah is about the liberation of Jerusalem. In the year 167 BCE, a Hellenist king attempted to outlaw Jewish practice and desecrate our temple in Jerusalem, but he failed. A small group of brave fighters, the Maccabees we call them in Hebrew, drove out the Hellenists and reclaimed Jerusalem. That is what we are celebrating. That is why we light the candles. We are honoring our brave ancestors who reinstated Jewish sovereignty more than 2,000 years ago over our capital, Jerusalem. History did not always turn out that way for our people. Just 100 years after the miracle of Hanukkah, our temple in Jerusalem was destroyed. The Jewish people were exiled from Jerusalem, but the connection between Jerusalem and the Jewish people was never broken. It will never be broken, not by the Romans, not by the Babylonians, not by the Ottoman Turks, not by the British Empire, and not by the United Nations. Today, even as our adversaries are once again seeking to delegitimize our presence in Jerusalem, the Jewish people will prevail as we always have. Mr. President, we have heard hateful statements from some world leaders over the past few days. Statements from countries that continue to be hostile to the Jewish people and to Israel. From leaders of nations that throughout history restricted Jewish prayer at the Western Wall. Even as late as 50 years ago, Jews were denied access in the Western Wall. So let me be very clear. Leaders of countries that oppress minorities, jail journalists, and quash all opposition have no right to lecture Israel. Leaders of countries poisoned by violent anti-Semitism cannot condemn Israel for so-called lack of tolerance and acceptance. Let me repeat what we have said time and again. Jerusalem under a sovereign Israel is more free and more open to people of all religions than at any other time in history. We pledge to ensure that all people of all religions will continue to be able to practice their faith freely in Jerusalem and throughout our entire country. Last year, at this council, you voted on Resolution 2334. I held up a Bible and reminded all of you of thousands of years of Jewish history and presence in Jerusalem. This year, with another resolution attempting to deny truth, we will fight back once more. Members of this council can vote again and again, hundreds and hundreds more times to denounce our presence in Jerusalem. But you will never succeed in changing the Bible. You cannot rewrite history. Not long ago, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, a wise Jewish leader, called the UN a house of darkness and lies. But he also noted that with just one small candle of truth, one could turn the darkness into light. We will continue to light that candle of truth. Tonight, millions of Jews around the world will light the seventh candle of Hanukkah. They will celebrate the unbreakable bond between the Jewish people and our eternal capital, Jerusalem. Now is the time for all countries to finally recognize that Jerusalem is always has been and always will be the capital of the Jewish people and the state of Israel. Thank you.
I thank the representative of Israel for his statement. There are no more names inscribed on the list of speakers. The meeting is adjourned.
U.S. President Donald Trump has revealed U.S. national security strategy. It has painted China and Russia as U.S. competitors that want to realign global power in their interest, potentially threatening the United States. Well, in this edition of the debate, we'll look at whether it's the U.S. and China that are the threats, or it is the U.S. that is painting them as such to pursue its own foreign policy agenda. We'll also look at how his plan is a break from his predecessor Obama's policies, like on Iran and North Korea. First, let's meet our correspondent from Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, who joins us right now. Well, anywhere that I read on this, it's definitely America first in every shape and form. That was my impression. What can you tell us, Colin?
Yeah, and that's consistent with what the president has been talking about along the campaign trail and, of course, after he was inaugurated, that he would put America first. And these are very America-centric policies. And although he admits there is a complex relationship between the U.S. and China, he believes that they can have some agreement on some issues, but they are definitely competitors in other issues, especially when it comes to trade, and especially what's happening in the South Asian Sea as well, when they have disagreements over what the boundaries are, what the borders are, when trying to gain access to that area. So again, we're going to hear the president talking about China as a competitor. We're going to be hearing about the president having cooperation with Russia on certain issues, even though there is a lot of skepticism over Russia's motivations and how they interact with the United States, especially when it comes to the elections. Now, while the president believes that to address these issues is relitigating the 2016 election, a lot of lawmakers on Capitol Hill are saying that Russia is a threat to U.S. democracy. And they say they're looking forward to future years when we have elections and whether or not Russia will try to influence those. So again, what the alarm here on Capitol Hill is that the president is not seriously addressing what type of influence Russia would have in U.S. relations. But again, in the speech that the president is expected to deliver within the hour, we're going to hear cooperation with Russia and cooperation with China on several issues, but definitely competition in other areas.
Thank you for that. Press TV's Colin Campbell there talking to us from Washington, D.C. Let's introduce our guest for this edition of the debate from the Answer Coalition. We have Brian Becker, who joins us from Washington, D.C. also, and the columnist at The Hill, Brent Podolsky, also joining us from Washington, D.C. Everyone's from Washington, D.C. tonight. Great. Very good. So let's start with you, Brent Podolsky, if I may. Looking at this U.S. national security strategy, just following up on some of the text that's out there, it says it follows America First doctrine of national sovereignty and putting a priority on the economic implications of global engagements. I'm not saying that, that's what's out there. Can you explain to us what that means exactly?
I don't know. First of all, let me wish everybody a happy holiday season in our audience, whatever country you're in and whatever faith you believe in. Mine is Christmas. I'm hoping I and Christians have a Merry Christmas. But I hope everyone, whatever holiday they believe in, has a good Christmas and a good New Year. The America First problem is simply that it doesn't really mean anything. It's a throwback to the 1930s for people who didn't want the United States to intervene against Hitler. I'm not saying Trump means it the same way, but it's not easy to execute a policy that's America First. People want France first, Germany first, Iran first, everybody first. What you have to do in the world is to find areas of common interest where we can cooperate. I hope we can, for example, with Russia and China, and areas where we're adversarial, which we are in many ways with Russia and China, among others. So the real issue is going to be how Trump carries out policies, not what he says, but what he does, how he carries out policies to balance those things. I hope we can have a more peaceful world. I hope we can cooperate with Russia and China. I also think we need to have a forceful response in economic terms and political and diplomatic terms to Russia's continuing attacks against America. And I hope we can have negotiated solutions to all of these problems. And I would particularly say Korea. where a war hurts everybody, and let's hope that they can avoid it with common sense and diplomacy.
Well, let me ask you, Brian Becker, how China and Russia, as the U.S. says, are its competitors, and they want to realign global power in their interest, potentially threatening the United States. Isn't that another way of saying that if the U.S. doesn't get his way, then China and Russia are in the way of U.S. interests?
Right, that you can only understand it in that way. I mean, of course, these documents are euphemistically worded, but what the document says, in addition to its very brazenly aggressive language, accusing other countries like China of economic aggression against the United States, it says, look, the world has returned unexpectedly to a major power rivalry status. In other words, something that had not been seen for nearly a century. That's very indicative language, because the great power struggles of a century ago, of course, led to World War I and led to World War II. And I believe the United States, and I think it's the military driving this document, it's mandated by Congress. Each president has his own sort of national security estimate. George W. Bush introduced and used the opportunity for this, the release of this presentation to unveil preemptive war, which signaled 6 months later the invasion of Iraq, a country that was technically at peace with the United States and was not threatening the United States. I think what the Trump administration and the Pentagon is doing is signaling that we're going to go to a major escalation of U.S. arms spending, and there's going to be an aggressive, contentious policy towards Russia in Eastern and Central Europe, particularly in Ukraine, in the former Soviet republics or allied sister socialist republics that crashed in the late 1980s, and a challenge to Asia, a challenge to China's supremacy in the Asia Pacific. So guess what? We're getting ready for a bumpy ride, because the U.S. has said, because China exists as a major power, because Russia has come back after having been on its knees in the 1990s as a large country with a big economy and thermonuclear capability, that they're going to be identified as competitors, not as partners. So I think it's a big shift.
Well, how much of this shift, Brent Podolsky, is there an underlying tone of aggression from the U.S.? I can't help recall to ask you your impression of this documentary maker, very world-renowned, John Pilger, who has one out called The Coming War with China. I mean, are we looking at what this is described as competition from China, or are we looking at something more than that? Of course, what we're looking at in the that part of the world, in the terms of the Far East, it paints a much more dim picture of what may amount to as a war breaking out of that area.
Well, I certainly hope there's no war with China, and I don't think there will be. Regarding China, the big truth of the matter is China and the United States need each other. So we are competing against each other in many ways, and we'll continue to. But we also need each other in economic and financial terms, and to cooperate, if possible, on Korea to avoid a war that would hurt everybody. So the balance that needs to be struck right now is the balance between competition and cooperation. Remember that what Trump campaigned on was the opposite of an aggressive, warlike kind of policy. America First, historically in the United States, stands for an almost isolationist policy. Now, he is growing into the job, for better or worse, we will ultimately find out. And the world is also growing into accepting him as president, which for the immediate future he will be. It's a balance between being able to compete, sometimes aggressively against other countries, but to cooperate when we can, equally aggressively, when our mutual interests are served. That is the great truth of foreign policy and national security for all nations. You have to compete where you must. You have to cooperate where you can. I don't think there's going to be a war with China. We have definite conflicts of interest, but we also have many areas of common interest. And smart diplomats and smart leaders will find ways to balance the two. That is what I hope happens.
What about Russia? If we can look at the way, Brian Becker, the U.S. has acted towards Russia, it almost seems like there's a schism there where you have Trump actually, in a sense, having a warmer approach to Putin as opposed to the rest of his Republican mates, because we're looking, for example, at maybe something that happened recently that shows how U.S. actually helped Russia with this terror threat that was supposed to happen in St. Petersburg, and Putin thanked Trump for that. I mean, are we looking at Russia being somewhat crossing paths with the U.S. in a aggressiveness may point out or come out of that?
If you're addressing it to me,
yes.
Okay, I'm sorry, I couldn't quite understand. Okay, yes, I mean, you know, there was made a big deal out of the fact that the CIA shared intelligence with the Russian government. The Washington Post wrote it up as if it was a sinister thing that Putin called Trump to thank him. If that attack had gone through, that would have been a huge carnage. I mean, it was a major religious facility, a Christian church in St. Petersburg, a very soft target. And if the attackers had succeeded, it would have been done with the goal of setting off Muslim Christian animosity throughout the Russian republics, some of which are majority Christian, some of which are majority Muslim. It would be an attack that we would expect maybe in Pakistan or in Iraq based on sectarian violence. But we haven't seen that kind of thing in Russia. So the CIA apparently provided information to Russia, and Russia was able to stop the attack from happening. And Putin called Trump and thanked him. And the Washington Post went out of its way and said, very unusual for the Russian president, prime minister to speak to the American president about such a thing, as if there was something sinister about it. There's been absolutely no proof at all offered so far, none, that Russia interfered in the 2016 election, or that the Russian interference in the 2016 election was the reason that Donald Trump won the Electoral College. There's been no proof whatsoever, but in Washington, the atmosphere, Democrat and Republican, liberal and conservative, the pillars of the establishment have decided that Russia is interfering with and maybe enfeebling American democracy. The political order apparently is so weak that $100,000 in Facebook ads, 56% of which took place after the election, were bringing down American democracy. I mean, it's kind of a hysteria, a witch hunt, and it's a precursor to reports like this, which also lead to an escalation in a new arms race, including the report emphasizes that nuclear weapons, America's nuclear arms and arsenal, is foundational to the U.S. deterrence strategy. And that's really something.
And one of the things that really stood out, first of all, do you have a reaction to what our guest there said, Brent Podolsky, to Brian Becker?
Oh, yeah. Look, if Press TV would give us a five-hour show, I'd be glad to explain to him the proof that Russia interfered in the American election and the European elections and is still waging
a cyber war. Just give a 30-second explanation. Give one little piece of evidence.
You really want to go there, pal? Do you really want to go there? Every
Just
American
one.
Intelligence and law enforcement and counterintelligence agency, every major European intelligence, counterintelligence agency, and law enforcement, they all believe Russia did it. You are virtually alone.
Cite one piece of evidence. Let me finish.
I just say that about 25 intelligence, counterintelligence, and military services.
No, you said that they believe. You said they all believe.
So you know more than all of them.
Cite one piece of evidence.
Brian, if you want to argue the Russian case, be my guest. Now, on the next point,
I'm arguing the evidence case.
It is not true that most of the American, please calm down. It is not true that most of the American media, including the Washington Post, treat it as sinister when Putin called Trump to thank him. Look, I assume it is true that the CIA helped the Russians stop a terror attack. I totally applaud that. I think that was a good and right thing to do. I think it's fine that Putin and Trump talked about that. I think it's excellent that we did it. I would hope that if we have terror threats against the United States, the Russians' intelligence, which we may be battling in many other ways, would contact the United States and help us. I think that was actually not sinister, but good. What we have to do, again, is to balance the competition and the cooperation to pursue national interests that we have in ways that will serve both countries. Russia will have to change some things in order for that to happen, or the sanctions will get worse. Russia has every right to ask the United States what we will do in return for them doing what we think they should do towards us. That's what diplomacy is. That's what the world requires. And whether it's China or Russia or Iran or Korea or any other issue in the world, we have to find ways to balance the areas where we disagree with the areas where we can cooperate, where we both all come out ahead when we can cooperate with each other. It's a balance, obviously.
When has the U.S. shown a balance? Can you give us some examples, Brian Becker?
I really can't. I mean, you know, President Bush, when George W. Bush came into office, he said he wanted to improve relations with Russia. When Barack Obama came into office, he said he wanted to improve relations with Russia. Hillary Clinton gave Lavrov, the foreign minister, that big red reset button that said, let's press that reset button, make better relations. Now, because Trump has said, I think Trump is a despicable political figure. The only thing that he said during the campaign that made some sense was, why not have better relations with Russia? And thus, he's treated as the Manchurian candidate of Russian foreign intelligence. And as if the people in Wisconsin voted for Donald Trump by a narrow margin because they were influenced by Sputnik or RT programming or something like that. I mean, this is nonsense. What we're really seeing here is that the U.S. is pivoting towards Asia and pivoting towards Russia with a very aggressive new foreign policy that seeks and sees in these countries not mainly partnership, but mainly competitors. At the same time, it identifies them as revisionist countries. Listen to that language. Why would China and Russia be revisionist? Because they're revising the post-World War II order, which was supposed to leave the U.S. as the unipolar superpower. Too bad the United States doesn't have like a mandate from heaven to rule over the entire planet. There's no reason why the rise of China or the reemergence of Russia as a strong country should not have with it the capacity for a U.S. partnership. But the U.S. doesn't see it that way because a strong China or a strong Russia obstructs the United States' very expansive foreign policy. NATO, the U.S. promised Russia NATO wouldn't expand eastward in 1991, and the instant they promised it, they started the expansion. So now Russia is accused of carrying out military exercises at its own border as if it's encroaching on NATO territory, while NATO is carrying out military exercises, including putting defense missile shields for first strike capability right on Russia's border. I mean, let's look at the facts.
But we only have a few minutes left. So, Brent Podolsky, I'd like to move on to another country, and that is Iran. And the way that Trump has come out dealing with Iran so far, and of course now with this national strategy that is going to be announced, of which we have some details. I mean, in some respects, he is trying to roll back what Obama and his administration achieved. And he has been very aggressive when it comes to Iran. In what ways do you see the future holding when it comes to the way Trump is going to deal with Iran?
Well, first of all, I support, as I did originally, the agreement between Iran, the United States, and the Europeans. I think the nuclear agreement is an important agreement. It is still alive. It is still working. I think it was right to do. It is true that Trump seems to have a desire to undo whatever it is that Obama has done. But what I think he's learning is it's not that easy. It's easy to talk about it. It's not that easy to do it. I hope the government of Iran will show restraint towards the United States and towards Syria and others and not become a hostile power in that region working against American interests. I also hope America will reciprocate by making the agreement with Iran work. I'd like to see Iran and the United States doing more trade and more cooperation. That's a classic case where both countries have to act in a way that is different than what we have today and that would bring common interests. We can work together as we did when the CIA helped Russia not be attacked by terrorists. That's one example of cooperation. When China works with the United States and others to deal with the Korean issue without a war, that's another area of cooperation. I'd like to see the United States and Iran, if Iran will stop doing some things that the United States opposes, and if the United States will stop doing things that Iran opposes, I'd like to see those two countries have a better relationship. It won't be easy, but it can be done.
Well, I have to ask you the same question there, Brian Becker. How do you see this going?
I see that what Trump is doing is undoing almost every policy of Obama, trying to sabotage the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran, trying to undo U.S.-Cuban normalization, withdrawing from the Paris Climate Treaty, canceling the TPP, introducing, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel when the United States abstained on the UN resolution in December 2016 that all other 14 members of the Security Council approved of, which condemned Israeli settlements in Jerusalem and in other occupied territories. What Trump is doing by, quote, making America first is abandoning the position that the United States has adopted since the end of World War II of being a guarantor for many of these multilateral processes around the world. It's a retreat. It's a reflection of a fading empire, and it's also a catalyst to help the empire fade even more in terms of its influence on global governance.
Very well. We're going to end it there. Thank you. Let me thank first our correspondent who joined us in the beginning of the program, First Vice Colin Campbell, and also Brian Becker there from the Answer Coalition. Thank you, and columnist of The Hill, Brent Podolsky. Thank you from Washington, D.C. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitavoy and the entire team in the Capitol, Tehran, goodbye. La 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 la